G'day, this is Tommy Wren of the Seriously Risky Business Newsletter, and I'm here with The Gruck again.
G'day, how you doing?
So this is our first podcast of 2023, so Happy New Year, Gruck.
And Happy New Year to you too, and happy birthday to everyone who celebrates on January 1st.
And I'd like to start by thanking our corporate sponsor, Proofpoint, and also the cyber initiative at the Hewlett Foundation, which supports this work. So, Gruck, you were telling me that you've been thinking about what happens after an operation gets burnt. So, what's the scenario? Take it away.
Right. So, I wouldn't limit it just to intelligence operations. Sort of, that's what I've been focusing on. But it's, you know, we can think about it as in the terms of like any cyber operation. And, you know, I think as a community, we sort of have this discourse which goes, you know, we look at how people gain access. We look at how people discover, you know, threat hunting or, you know, other types of exposure on that. And then the conversation sort of stops. Like we've done everything that interests us. But for the other side, I think things go on. That's where, you know, the other part of the operation starts is what do you do once it's over in the worst case scenario sort of over. And it's really fascinating if you think about it, right? So, you know, you're like John Smith, the operator, and you get up on Tuesday and you go into work and you tippy-tappy on your computer and your shells aren't there, right? You can't connect to anything. So maybe the network is down or something for a little bit and afternoon comes around, you still can't connect.
Yep.
Maybe Wednesday comes and you still can't connect now.
Yep.
Now you're getting a bit worried because this is not really right. This is unusual. So, you know, at some point you have to go like, okay, this op is burned, but was it burned because someone rebuilt a computer? Did it get burned because, you know, we were discovered by a threat intel company and, you know, next week we're going to be in a white paper where all of our tools are exposed and our infrastructure gets burned?
Yep.
Is one of these threat intel companies that found it now poking around our infrastructure because they're trying to figure out what's going on? And not just the stuff that we used for this specific attack, but everything we use for all of our attacks, is that compromised? What is the blast radius of this thing? Like, how far out does it go and how much needs to be fixed to do the next operation? Because...
Yep. So in the word burned implies to me the other side has discovered it. Whereas in that scenario, it's not even clear to me that you have been discovered, right? You've just lost access. It could I don't know, a firewall change or...
Right. It literally could be anything from the, you know, you were connected to the secretary's box and someone spilled a cup of coffee on it and now it had to get replaced and it has nothing to do with you, to someone went, hey, that's funny, and was like, oh my God, look at this thing. It could be anything in there. And
yep. So the question is, what do you do, right?
Right. But even as part of that, I think some of the psychology is really interesting because you don't know, right? So that's part of the stress from this sort of event is that you do not know why you've lost access. So there's this huge stress of not knowing what has gone wrong, right? So it's one thing if someone spilled coffee on the box and got replaced. That's fine. You don't need to update anything or change what you're doing. You can just reaccess. You know, you can break into the new one. But if Mandiant is in the process of writing up, you know, a new threat actor discovered with blah, 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 you know, here's the IOCs, you need to change a huge amount of stuff. And you don't know which of those two extremes you're in. And you can't know until something shows up. So that's, you know, that can be highly stressful. And then, you know, let's assume that you've decided, okay, we must have been discovered. We need to go forward on the principle of like, this is the worst case scenario and we're going to be in a white paper or a blog post or something.
I guess depending upon the operation, there might be hints that you've been discovered versus accidental, right? I guess if you're on a single box and that disappears, it's like, who knows? But if you're on 50 boxes and they all disappear at the same time, I mean, it could be something else, but you'd be more...
Yeah, you'd be a lot more suspicious. But, you know, there's other things as well, like frequently people will start monitoring like the system administrator's right? And you might see a message coming along saying, hey, is anyone connecting at 4 a.m. to our routers because I'm seeing that in the logs, and you can go, okay,
yep,
you know, time to get out of Dodge. But that can happen. But then you start thinking, like, how do we respond to this situation? Right? You've got the implants that you used, right? You've got the exploits that you used. You've got the infrastructure that you used. And you've got your tradecraft as well, right? Like just the way that you operate. Plus, obviously, you were there for a reason. So if you're a state, you had tasking of some sort, you know, read their emails or find out who they are shipping their ball bearings to or, you know, whatever. And as a state, your tasking hasn't changed, even though your access has been lost, right? You still need to read the email. So you're going to have to go back and get access to the emails again. So how much do you have to change before that happens? You know, do you recompile with a different set of options and a new bunch of strings and just reuse what you had before?
Yeah, it's pretty clear to me that there's a range of actors out there who take different approaches to all these questions. Like, I think they're all interesting questions. It's obvious just looking at the way those big intelligence organizations operate that they've thought about this a lot. So I'm thinking about the Western agencies, the Five Eyes agencies. Just from the public reporting, you can tell that they take a lot of care to not get caught. But it's there's a whole diversity of actors. What I'm wondering about is how you make those decisions. Like, what's the basis for making that decision? Like, many of the things you've talked about, you really need to have thought about beforehand, right? If you're so, I was thinking about implants while you were talking. You've got an implant, presumably it's beaconing away. It never receives anything after any reply. Right. Like, you know, should you have programmed it to delete itself? And
right.
And,
it's just there for 30 days, nothing happens, it goes poof, or some time period, right? Or did you not think about that because you're a 17-year-old from Romania and you're just trying to make some money and you haven't put any consideration into what happens tomorrow?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. For example. And if you haven't thought about it beforehand, it's once the access is gone, it's too late, right?
It's a bit late.
Right. The other interesting thing is that it seems that there's definitely Russian actors who've thought about these things because they are extremely stealthy, but there's also other groups that seem to think about it a bit less, and that's sort of a bit curious to me.
Right. Well, I'd say there's also Russian actors who've thought about it because they've been caught quite a lot. At some point, you have to learn, I guess. But I think it's interesting how, for example, with China, you know, clearly there's just this wide range of, I guess, professionalism might be a way of looking at it. So that you've got sort of very high skill sets and a lot of forethought has gone into what's happening. And then you've got not as high skill sets and considerably less attention to detail and preparing for the future. And I wonder if just even thinking about what happens when the operation is over, if that's a mark of professionalism to a degree. It shows an understanding of a life cycle of an operation and the ways that they can terminate voluntarily or not.
Yeah, on one level, I like the word professionalism because it does seem to capture what's going on. But there do seem to be Chinese groups that are professional in that they're operationally sophisticated, I guess. Like they're a factory in a way that churns out intelligence.
Right.
The ones I'm thinking of are kind of the contractor types who seem to be tasked, and we spoke about this before, they seem to be tasked to get intellectual property. And it seems like there's a variety of targets. And so it's not the end of the world if one company boots them out, right? They can be at least a bit opportunistic. Whereas that perhaps for other actors, there's only one State Department, for example.
Right. Yeah. There's only so many OPMs that you can gain access to and then you run out of OPMs.
I suppose the OPM example is an interesting one in that I was wondering if there's some aspect where what separates the ones that are really careful about it is that they realize that they need an enduring access. Perhaps, and this is a bit of speculation, I guess, getting access to OPM today is good enough. you know, we build a database, it serves our short-term purpose. There'll be some other company with a whole lot of American data that we can access.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, no, I think that's an important aspect of, I'm going to use the word tasking, but I, you know, obviously ransomware groups don't exactly have tasking, but
they've got goals.
Yeah, you've got objectives and things
that
you're trying to do.
Objectives.
And
yep.
Yeah, you know, goals, objectives, and so on. And so those can be served by basically any company that's willing to pay, for example, with ransomware. Like it doesn't matter if it's a hospital or the sneaker factory or, you know, a mom and pop store or an office or anything. It just, anyone who can pay is good enough. So clearly they're, I guess, omnivorous in terms of their targeting. But as we were saying, like a State Department, there's only, you know, there's one State Department. There's not a lot of alternatives. And I think one thing I'd like to come back to afterwards is sort of how, when an operation is compromised, that has sort of continuing effects that impact, you know, future operations, sort of in terms of this being able to have long-term access. So in terms of the, you know, having continuing presence or continuing access, I think that that also comes down to objectives. And I think we'll find that a lot of the time it's only, I don't want to say an elite, but that's sort of what I mean. Like it's a small group of people whose job is to provide continuing intelligence on specific targets compared to gain access to something and get money from it, or go and find out a snapshot of today's nanotechnology stuff from the majority of the top nano companies that you can find, right? Where just having a, you know, a snapshot can be enough to sort of bootstrap your industry to that level.
Yeah, so one interesting report just the other week was that a particular law firm in Washington, D.C. had been compromised by Hafnium.
Uh-huh.
The Microsoft call them Hafnium, and they're a Chinese APT, and they're after policy work related to the Biden administration and China. Uh-huh. And that seems like a really good intelligence requirement. It seems like a pretty high-level one in that it's of interest to the Foreign Ministry of Foreign Affairs rather than just intellectual property there. But I thought it was really interesting that they, the place they went after that was lawyers. And that seems to me, I guess, to relate to this discussion in that's a choice to seek that intelligence in this place where probably, I'm assuming, a law firm, cybersecurity, not that good, chance of getting busted by the U.S., actually pretty high in this case, it turns out. But that's sort of a risk decision that they've taken to do that.
Right. And I think the thing is, when you're taking that sort of, you know, sort of connecting that back to our sort of discussion, when you're taking a sort of risk decision on where will we hit, what are the odds of getting caught, what are the risks of being exposed, you make those decisions about which exploits you're going to use and which implant you're going to use. You know, do you use your latest and greatest super elite shiny one that must be maintained super secretly, or one that it's a bit of a beater, and if it gets burned, it gets burned, and, you know, life goes on. So I think choosing targets in this way is part of the preparation for if operations get burned, right? Is you go after the law firm, not the Pentagon.
The Secretary of State or whatever.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that operations getting burnt have, put words into your mouth, enduring or continuing effects?
Absolutely. I accept those words. Yeah. So here's the thing, right? As we were saying, you've got, let's take the lawyer example that we've been talking about. So you've got tasking to find out about, the soy tariffs and, you know, pork exports or something along those lines. You find the people dealing with that, you gain access, you monitor it for a while, you get discovered. Now, you're going to have to go back, but these guys are now, they're alerted, they're aware that they are targets. So, for example, you may have gained access with a phishing attack the first time, but if you try and go back with a phishing attack after, you know, there's just been this whole investigation and they've had to, you know, bring people in for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of incident response, that phishing attack is probably not going to be successful, right? You're going to have to do something else to get in. But even when you do get in, they are probably now aware that there'll be more security software there. There'll be more active monitoring of, well, we found an implant last time on the Exchange server. So every Sunday, let's check the Exchange server to see if there's more implants.
Yep.
I guess the paths that you have to take start getting more and more heavily monitored. And so taking those paths becomes more and more difficult. And as a defender, once you notice that someone is taking the same path, you sort of know where to look. You develop the sense of like, okay, well, if anyone's gaining access, they're going to try and get to the Exchange server, so let's check there first.
Yeah. So I guess the assumption there, I suppose there's a couple. One is that they're an enduring target, and the second is that they'll actually do something to improve security. I think that for at least some organizations, those are pretty reasonable, right? I remember one of the stories I wrote about a purported South American hacktivist group, Guacamaya. They gave a tremendously in-depth breakdown of the sort of network penetration.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they did was set up several different ways of retaining access if they were burnt. So I suppose, at the very beginning of this thought process, what do you do after you've been burnt? You would say, well, we'll put down 3-4 different ways of retaining access. And that, I was wondering as you were talking, what would be the way that would tip you off, like being burnt versus just some network change or some accidental? And that, I guess that would probably be the thing, right?
Yeah. So my limited understanding of these things is that when one does gain access to, we're assuming it's not like you're going to like read Tom's email. There's a limited number of things we could do to maintain access to that. But if it's like, gain access to the State Department, well, you can get into the network in one place and put in, your Cobalt Strike beacon.
Yeah.
And then you go to another part of the network and you put in, a connect back SSH backdoor that, once a month will connect to, an IP address. And then you go to another part of the network and you drop in an email-based backdoor of some sort. And you sprinkle all these things around and then you make sure that you only ever use one, your Cobalt Strike one as your path of entry. And when that gets discovered and gets burned, you have all of these other ways that can get you back in and you can find out, was it a bot got rebuilt or replaced or, were you discovered?
Yeah, so in this case, Guacamaya, they had a particular political goal. So they were in a particular mining company that they thought was doing environmentally bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it was. And mining so company. They set up multiple accesses because they wanted to do something to this particular company. But they also had many other companies. So it wasn't the end of the world. They did set it up, but they were somewhat cavalier about it. They're like, oh, well, yeah, we'll do this. Whereas I guess at one end of the spectrum, you've got just people who don't care about enduring access and probably wouldn't even bother.
So,
I was wondering about ransomware crews. Nation states, you would think, would be on the very other extreme where they're, I guess nation states would be have a spectrum, right? We sort of talked about some just don't seem, or some actors in nation states don't seem to care. Probably at the, I want to call it the top end, but the most specific end, or I don't know, the sort of the State Department targeting end.
You're right. And I think that depends a lot on the tasking as well, right? So there might be the, if the Olympics are coming up, then you will have tasking related to, the Olympic planning committees and all that stuff. But then once it's over, you don't really, you don't need access to the 2019 of the 2018 Olympics sort of thing. So I think it's worth keeping in mind that even these very elite teams can have short-term operations and stuff. So
yeah, finite ones. Yeah.
Finite, there we go. So one of the things that I think is quite interesting with the ransomware stuff is how the initial access brokers sort of how they rate their skill development. So this is a slight tangent, but it's related to this, because if you are an initial access broker, the way that you make money is by selling access, you know, tautologically. But the thing is, the more access you have, the more money you make. The amount of money you make per target that you sell is not a very wide spread. Like, it doesn't go up into the millions all of a sudden. So you are just going to maximize the number that you have rather than the quality. And when you're maximizing quantity, what becomes useful is finding potential targets, not necessarily gaining access to any one specific target, right? So if you're going to invest in your skill set, what you actually want to invest in is your Ascent research skills to find companies, not necessarily into exploitation skills.
Right. And so that's a breadth versus depth approach, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is reflected in their approach to losing access as well, right? Like, if you're hitting several hundred companies and you're expecting 5% success rate, if that drops to like 4.9, it's not the end of the world, because it's still in your ballpark. So
yeah,
I think
the incremental value is not very high.
There we go. I'm good at words. So the incremental value of any one company is not particularly high. It's fairly minimal. But in aggregate, that's where your money is. So even as a ransomware team, your goals are not based on having long-term access. It's very much smash and grab.
Yeah.
Get in, grab your stuff, and get your money and move on. And
I was just thinking, for ransomware, there's probably a risk that if you are too stealthy and take too long, some other ransomware crew will come along and screw things up where you get caught, and you might get swept up in the remediation action anyway.
Yeah, there you go. Or, I mean, yeah, even worse, you know, all of your stuff gets burned, but you get nothing.
That's right.
Yeah, so we can look at how ransomware groups approach this issue of, like, constantly being burned, like your ops constantly get blown. Right, because that's literally the point of a ransomware operation. You know, it's not much good if no one knows it happened.
And I guess, interestingly, there they set up beforehand, they've thought about setting up a means of communication that doesn't rely on the target network being present.
Yeah, exactly. So that's great stuff. I was just thinking about, like, you know, we were saying stuff like, if you're a nation state, you have to decide, do you use your top of the line implant? Do you use maybe a slightly older one because it's, you know, going to get burned? Do you use new infrastructure that's compartmented and that won't impact any of your other stuff? Do you use your existing infrastructure because it's cheaper and you don't want to, you know, requisition a new VPS or whatever it is? The ransomware groups basically have these rolling updates where they're constantly changing the IOCs to a degree of their tooling and stuff, because they've just factored in that they're always going to be burning their current tooling. So they just constantly roll new updates all the time. And I think it's interesting how that has been integrated into their approach to operations, as they just accept reburning their stuff so that they just always upgrade. Whereas I think a nation state is going to be looking at the cost of developing a new implant from scratch and going, how much longer can we use the old one? You know, it's still fine.
So far we've come up with one of the key drivers might be a breadth versus depth thing. So some actors really care about very specific targets, and that sort of drives their choices. Other actors, you use the word omnivorous, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, there's always another target. Opportunistic, perhaps, would be another way to describe it.
Yeah.
I guess there was at one point actors thought that they cared about attribution, or nation-state actors.
The price of being discovered exists whether you get white-papered or not. And that can be, you have to update your stuff anyway. So, you know, if you're a nation state actor and you do get discovered, even if you don't get written up publicly, your IOCs are burned, right? So you still need to update your tooling. But you have to make decisions about, like, well, do we update it for, you know, China only? Because China has now discovered our stuff and we can continue to use it in France and the UK and Russia without any problem because they don't know and they don't share, you know, signatures with each other. Or do we have to update for everyone? Then there's the, once you've been discovered, you know, those costs that we were talking about of, you know, if your objectives are known, then the paths that you have to go after, those are known. It doesn't matter whether that's publicly posted or not. The target that you have to hit knows that you have to hit them and where you need to hit them. So that, you know, that's a price you pay regardless of what happens afterwards. But it can also be, if it does go public, then, you know, your stuff is being burned everywhere. Right. Even if it's not attributed. Right. So even if someone just goes, we found a new advanced threat actor that is targeting dairy farms. Yep. You know, and here's what we found in their dairy farm operations in, you know, Ruthenia or, you know, wherever. And now all dairy farms everywhere are going to have heightened scrutiny for your tool set and your tradecraft. And that's going to have a cost, even if they didn't say, you know, it was the Albanians.
Yep. So in fact, probably of all those costs, I actually think the attribution one might really be the least. Like, it's kind of taking the point of view of the threat actor, right? You know, you get politically attributed, like attributed by your, by another government. Uh-huh. They out you. It's like, well, that's no extra work. Like, there's all this technical work that I've got to do that was that occurred regardless of the political attribution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if we look at the Albania and Iran thing, it's like it doesn't really matter to the Iranians that they were called out for being Iranians, right? That doesn't change, you know, all of the issues that they had to go through to, you know, retool after they'd done their huge denial of service attacks. You know, being identified as Iranians didn't impact the budget of any of those groups involved in any way.
Yeah, I guess to argue against myself, I can imagine the Iranians not really caring all that much about being attributed. I can imagine that some other countries would care and that might actually flow down into more work because they'd say you've got to make extra careful.
Right, yeah. New rule. Everyone has to go through 20 more bounces before they're allowed to, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Seven proxies.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting topic in that it's not something that as a community we talk about. Like, we all talk about access, how you get in, and then when someone has access, how you find them. And we don't really think about what happens. We don't think about them after we find them and kick them out of our systems, you know?
Won't bad guys have feelings too.
Won't someone think of the attackers? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's very interesting because there are these knock-on effects that happen when they do get discovered. There are implications that come out of every operation that gets burned. And I think it's worth thinking about and discussing because there's just so much there that we haven't thought about as a community, whether it's the exposure is one type of burning, but just discovery in and of itself has costs that are implied.
I have seen someone argue that it's kind of a cumulative effect. So, you know, you discover an adversary's malware or whatever, you learn a whole lot about it, and then you can key off any of the different aspects, like the technical aspects or maybe the tactics or the intended target or and of course the target's the hardest one to get away from because if they care about it, they still care about it. And then the next time you've got this kind of array of signatures, isn't the right word, but clues,
smells,
or yeah, and so that makes it increasingly hard.
Okay.
And that seems to be, I guess, what you're talking about there,
right? That's you have eloquently put what I have struggled to express. Thank you very much.
I'm going to have to learn how to do the beep thing. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks a lot, man. Always good to talk to you. Catch you later.